Police video excerpt. Falcon Academy conference room interview. Bellman, Natalie Marie. Continued. The tea has cooled down, and Natalie is holding the mug up to her lips while she looks at the table. Most of her face is in shadow. At the moment, no one's talking. Detective Bradley is checking messages on his phone, but the camera is still recording. Natalie sets her tea down and stares longingly out the window. It's snowing. After a second, Detective Bradley puts his phone on the table. Natalie senses his gaze and turns away from the window to face him.
Do you know the difference between manslaughter, murder one, and murder two?
He asks. Natalie nods.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure, because if someone who has been a good person their whole life gets really upset and makes a mistake in the heat of the moment, a mistake that ends tragically in a way that they regret, if that person comes forward and confesses, things are not nearly so bad for them in terms of consequences. Do you understand?
How am I supposed to understand any of this? Two people? Was it murder? Suicide? An accident? How am I possibly supposed to understand?
Someone was slowly dying while you were in the sports pavilion, Natalie. Someone was bleeding out that afternoon and evening while you were walking in and out as if you hadn't a care in the world.
Detective Larson appears from out of frame, and her hand drops onto Natalie's shoulder. What do you think happened in the gym that afternoon, Natalie? I think, Natalie says, after pulling her shoulder away from Detective Larson's touch, that someone did something that was very, very bad. 11. Natalie was bent over her computer, typing up a flyer inviting all parents to consider signing their children up for summer camp at the Wilderness Science Center. A unique experience, especially suited for students with an interest in animals and the outdoors, with registration beginning. She looked up to see Nick standing there.
Hi, Miss Bellman. How are you?
I'm fine, she said, her face lighting up. How are you, Mr. McGuire?
Good.
He stood there looking at her, and she sat there looking at him, both wearing goofy smiles. Yvonne cleared her throat. How can I help you? Natalie asked him.
Are we hanging out this afternoon?
He whispered, glancing over his shoulder at Rex, the security guard, whose head was slightly turned in their direction as if to hear better. Natalie nodded vigorously.
Awesome,
he said softly.
I can't wait.
He resumed talking in a normal voice.
I'm over here because I've got an issue that I need to discuss with Mark.
Yvonne looked up from behind her computer screen. He's free. If you want to see him now, I'll let him know.
Thank you, Yvonne,
Nick said.
That would be great.
After leading Nick back to the study, Yvonne returned and said, Is it me, or was Mr. McGuire just now acting like he'd undergone, like, a lobotomy? Jesus, drool much? Natalie felt a pleasant warmth bloom like a flower in her chest. After the meeting with Nick, Mr. Dilly came out to see Natalie and Yvonne.
Girls,
he said, putting his hands on his hips and looking up at the ceiling as if the sky was about to fall. He seemed at a loss for words.
How can I put this? We have a situation, and it's going to require a very sensitive approach. I think the best thing to do would be to call the boys in first, determine the collateral damage. Let's do that before I speak with the...
He paused.
The other party.
I'm sorry, Mr. Dilly, Yvonne said. Can you be a bit more...
I have to use the bathroom,
he declared, making a face.
I'll be right back.
When he was gone, Yvonne leaned over and said to Natalie, Do you know what this is all about? I have no idea, Natalie answered. It's weird, right? I wonder what kind of situation we're in for. A delicate situation? A dangerous situation? Natalie used her chin to gesture in the direction of the office bathroom. Or are we at stage 3, a diarrhea situation? Yvonne, who had little self-control when it came to laughing, had to cover her mouth. When she was able to speak, she said, Stage 4, dead body situation. Somebody must have kicked the bucket. 5 minutes later, Mr. Dilly reappeared, a little grayer with some sweat on his upper lip, and said,
Now listen, this all has to remain private. I can't have either of you talking about this, understand?
They both nodded.
All right then, Mr. Dilly said. This is what we'll do.
Mr. Dilly asked Natalie to contact the parents of five boys, a group who had been hanging out together for years. They were an odd ensemble comprised of two athletes, a theater geek, a drummer in the marching band, and a good-looking video gamer with his own YouTube channel. The message she was asked to convey to the parents was clear. A meeting was mandatory, and time was of the essence. Natalie managed to schedule a sit-down in the study for the next day, just after lunch, for representatives of three out of the five families involved. Reed Leland's mom, Linda, stayed at home, and the word around the school was that she literally stayed at home. No one had seen much of her in the past few years. Rumor had it she liked her benzos, so Natalie wasn't surprised when the woman volunteered her husband for the meeting. Reed's father, Howard, called Natalie back right away. She suspected he ran his cybersecurity company remotely, so it wasn't a problem for him to take some time off for a school meeting. Even at Falcon, where many of the families had some ties to fame or fortune, the Solomons were somewhat unapproachable. Natalie left a message on Jeremiah Solomon's mother's work phone. She was an advertising executive. It was Jeremiah's dad, Derek, a retired NFL player, who called back an hour later in response to her measured invitation to visit the school the following day.
I want to know what this is all about right this second, he said.
Natalie reiterated several times that she had been explicitly instructed to keep the issue extremely confidential, which Mr. Solomon eventually came to appreciate. Susie Woodson was very protective of her son, Greg, so she agreed to the meeting without much in the way of information, despite the fact that she spent half of every week in Denver as the busy CEO of a large cable television company. Neither of Alistair Reynolds' parents returned Natalie's calls. 2 hours later, she walked down to the theater, where Alistair was having debate class, and asked if he could perhaps get in touch with one of them for her. He responded that they were at a yoga retreat in Costa Rica. His aunt was house-sitting with him and his sister. When Natalie asked when his parents would be returning, his answer was,
3 weeks, or five, sometime this summer.
Casper Nowak and his family had abruptly left the country just the previous day, and though it was their habit to summer in Poland, this was the first time they'd begun their vacation before the end of the school year. The following afternoon was a circus in the front office, with the parents coming and going with their heads hanging low, as if they were celebrities who didn't want to be photographed by the paparazzi. The boys were less effacing. At one point, Reed Leland slouched against the wall next to Natalie's desk, with his arms crossed over his formidable chest for 30 minutes. His long bangs hung down below his well-tended brows, but she could still see his eyes. Green and cold, they were both gorgeous and unsettling. Reed was an undeniably handsome 17-year-old. He played lacrosse in the spring, wrestled in the winter, and was the captain of the soccer team in the fall. To Natalie, he looked like the sort of boy who would go on to pledge a good fraternity, major in economics with a minor in sexual assault, and eventually become a businessman like his dad. Had his circumstances been less affluent, she assumed he would have been just fine because of his looks alone. There was always Chippendales, reality television, and porn. Eventually, Natalie said, "The headmaster is ready for you now, Reed." He gave her a slight upjerk of his chin in acknowledgement. She felt, intuitively and somehow hopefully, that he was in massive trouble. Jeremiah Solomon was the last to leave the study. Natalie noticed that Greg Woodson was pacing in the hallway. As soon as he saw Jeremiah, he grabbed him by the arm and started dragging him down the hall. Judging by appearance alone, they were unlikely friends. Jeremiah was not only a good football player like his dad, but he was considered a cool kid with short, dyed blonde dreadlocks, dual diamond stud earrings, and full male model lips. Greg, on the other hand, had a gaunt face covered in acne and knock-kneed bird legs that had required braces until the eighth grade. His mom, Susie, loved her geeky son very much. She'd been actively courting the friendship of the best boys in the Falcon Valley area since Greg was in elementary school by inviting them on irresistible playdates. Reed Leland had accompanied Greg by private jet to the Rose Bowl in Pasadena to see Eminem perform when they were 11. Jeremiah had accompanied Greg and his parents on their family spring break holiday to their waterfront villa in the Florida Keys for 5 years running. Other Falcon boys had been similarly romanced over the years. Susie had accomplished her mission to keep her son from being ostracized, but she couldn't make him handsome. She had succeeded in creating a teenage boy who was ridiculously entitled, as well as furious at the world. In time, this close group of privileged friends had whittled down to a party of five: Greg, Reed, Jeremiah, Alistair, and Casper. At after-school happy hour gatherings, many of the teachers secretly referred to the pack of wild boys as the Dingoes. Today, Greg was wearing faded and ripped jeans that were belted about halfway up his rear end, high-top sneakers that weren't laced, and a baggy gray sweatshirt. He didn't need to dress like a billionaire. Everyone knew who he was and what he was. As Natalie watched the two boys head down the hall away from her, she saw Greg Woodson shove Jeremiah so hard that the bigger boy almost fell. Natalie jumped to her feet. "Yvonne, I'll be right back." The boys turned left, going through the double doors that opened onto the covered walkway, leading to the sports pavilion. Natalie was about to go through the doors too when she realized they had stopped on the other side. Greg was shouting, and it was easy for her to listen to their conversation. "Can you believe this? What did the photos look like? How many were there? Who shared them with me? Who did I show them to? On and on and on. Oh my God, I have a headache." Jeremiah's voice was as deep as if he were a grown man, and he always sounded serious. "That sucked. My mom is going to cry when my dad tells her. I don't know what I'm going to say. This is terrible." Greg, on the other hand, sounded like a squeaky, hysterical boy in the middle of a voice change. "What kind of stuff do they ask you?"
"Same shit as you."
"Humor me with a recap."
"You know, like, did you look at and share the photos? Who with? Whether I posted them anywhere?"
Satisfied that Greg Woodson and Jeremiah Solomon were not about to get into a fist fight, Natalie pushed the heavy door open and acted surprised to see them. She smiled brightly. "Hi, boys," she said. "Are you headed over for sports?" Jeremiah nodded and looked away.
"Yeah."
Greg stared at Natalie coldly.
"Did you want a word with us, Miss Bellman?"
Natalie felt the little hairs on the back of her neck stand on end, and she answered, "No," before letting the door fall closed. At the end of the day, Nick was again alone in the study with Mr. Dilly when Mrs. Elliman appeared outside on the sidewalk. She was pressing the entrance buzzer to be let in repeatedly, as was her habit. At first, Natalie didn't suspect any connection between Mrs. Elliman's arrival and the earlier parade of parents and students, as she had never been asked to place a call to Sloane's mom. Rex went through his usual rigmarole to let her into the building. Mrs. Elliman appeared agitated and even slightly disheveled, if it was possible to be disheveled in a gray and black designer ensemble of cashmere and leather. Natalie had never seen her looking anything less than flawless. "Mrs. Elliman, are you looking for Sloane? Can I call her for you?" "No," she answered. "Leave her out of this debacle for now. Is he in there?"
"Who?"
Natalie asked, and then realized how ridiculous it sounded.
"I'm sorry, are you here to see the headmaster or Mr. McGuire?"
"Both," she answered, wiping one eye in a despondent way.
"Okay, let me just—"
"No, no," Mrs. Elliman crossed behind the desk to the hallway. Natalie and Yvonne looked on in astonishment as the woman proceeded to enter the study where Mr. Dilly was oblivious to her arrival, without so much as a perfunctory knock. 45 minutes later, it was nearing the end of the school day, and Yvonne and Natalie were finishing up their administrative work. Mr. Dilly poked his head out of the study and said,
I'd like you to go ahead and pack up, ladies. I know technically you're on the clock for another 30 minutes, but let's just make it an early day.
Without waiting for an answer, he went back into his office to continue his conversation with Mrs. Elliman.
Sweet, Yvonne said. Let's go to happy hour at Tequila Harry's. I'll buy you a Coke.
Sounds good, Natalie answered.
Don't dilly-dally now, little miss, or I might have to, I don't know, get out my whistle, Yvonne said with a wink.
What?
Natalie smiled, reaching under her desk for her bags.
You know what I'm talking about, Mr. McGuire, always flirting with you?
Nah, that's crazy talk,
Natalie answered, grabbing her jacket. She wasn't ready to tell Yvonne, too new.
He's such an old dog, Yvonne said. He's after everybody.
Is he?
Natalie asked, suddenly frozen in the process of packing up her things to go.
Totally. Me, Denise, Berta, Mrs. Leland, Mrs. Elliman, all the moms, really, even the lunch lady.
Rosie is like 70, Natalie said.
Yeah, but he makes her laugh like she's being tickled.
You know what, Yvonne, Natalie said. I forgot, I need to go walk Jay's dog. I'm so sorry, my bad, I can't do happy hour.
Let's pick up a six-pack and surprise Jay. I'll come with you.
I'm sorry, I really can't.
Yvonne put her hands on her hips and said,
Fine, another time then. I'd like to remind you, however, that I still haven't collected my caviar lobster roll and bottle of Veuve owed me from the last time you made plans with me and then canceled.
But all Natalie could think about was how many women Nick was sleeping with. At home that night, Natalie social media stalked Nick and his long-distance, long-time friend named Amelie Bernard, as well as Brooke Elliman and Linda Leland, the two Falcon moms Yvonne had said he was known to flirt with on occasion. Amelie, more often referred to as Millie, was the most threatening. She was an actress, albeit an out-of-work actress. Young, petite, and with a little edge to her, she wore a pink streak in her white blonde hair and frequently glared at photographers with pure hatred that was somehow very sexy. Brooke and Linda were surgically improved, good-looking cougars whose Instagram pages showed them attending charity events in designer clothes. Natalie felt slightly better. They seemed a little too manufactured for what she felt was Nick's taste. Eventually, Natalie took a Vicodin and worked on her most recent pet portrait request through Etsy, in this case a bit of a challenge, as she'd never before been asked to paint a ferret wearing a striped sweater. She finished at 11 and stood back, thinking that it might be up there with her favorites. Her phone beeped and she had a text from Nick.
I just wanted to say goodnight, sleep tight, and I miss you.
An explosive surge of happiness made her feel almost dizzy, and Natalie wanted to celebrate. She played a love song by Ellie Goulding on her laptop and spun around the studio as if it were a dance floor bathed in pulsing, colored party lights. She was so thankful she'd come to Falcon Valley. For the very first time in her life, she was the lucky one, thinking, it's almost too good to be true.
12.
Asha's feet were freezing. She wished she hadn't taken off her socks. The nurse hadn't said anything about socks. It was just, get undressed and here's your gown. She could have kept her socks on. Her feet had nothing to do with a pelvic exam. Someone knocked on the door of the examination room.
I'm ready,
Asha called from her prone position on the table. The door opened. Asha tilted her head to the side and saw her gynecologist, Dr. Ruiz, enter the room.
Hi, Elena, she said.
Elena responded warmly while sanitizing her hands in the corner.
Hi, Asha. This is such an amazing and wonderful surprise.
So this is happening? Asha asked.
It's real? The lab test says it's real. Are you excited?
I'm scared.
Of course you are. That's completely normal to be nervous.
I don't know how I can do this.
You can do this, Asha, and you've got Phil. Where is he, by the way? I would have thought he'd want to be here for this.
Asha closed her eyes and took a deep breath.
He's got other stuff going on.
Other stuff besides a new baby? Must be important.
I'm afraid so, yes, very important.
Elena began to examine Asha's breasts.
Well, you're going to be good. You're strong, you're healthy.
She moved on to probing her abdomen.
I'm very confident that we can get you through this pregnancy without any major problems and that you're going to be the mom of a wonderful little girl who you will love so, so much.
A little girl?
Asha asked.
It's too soon to tell, isn't it?
Oh,
Elena said, reaching for her speculum.
It's far too soon, I would imagine. Can you put your feet in the stirrups, please?
But you did say little girl. Is it something about the way I'm carrying the baby?
No,
Elena said, her voice a little off. She cleared her throat. Asha lifted herself up a little to look her doctor in the eye.
Is everything okay?
Fine. I'm fine. I apologize.
Elena began the pelvic examination, and Asha went quiet, gritting her teeth.
I guess, Elena said as she opened Asha up, I might have been projecting a little, hoping for a girl for you. My time I had with my daughter was the best, most beautiful, happiest part of my life.
Then Asha remembered. The doctor's daughter had died a few years ago. Driving home from her appointment, Asha felt unusually hopeful. Elena had said she had every reason to expect a normal pregnancy, despite her age. She was a healthy, strong woman, and she'd already given birth to 2 children who were thriving. Thriving. Asha loved the sound of the word. She said it out loud.
Thriving.
Despite the fact that it was closing in on dinner time and they usually had pizza on Thursdays, Asha pulled into McDonald's for the first time in several years. Baby wanted French fries. She'd just get a small, maybe a medium. When the voice came over the loudspeaker to ask her for her order, she said,
A 1/4 pounder with cheese, large fries, and an apple pie.
After pulling into the garage at her house, she considered wolfing her snack down right there in the car. Her kids were rarely allowed fast food. She never bought it for Phil, even though he liked it, and she didn't want to get caught. On the other hand, it sounded far more fun to take it to her office and enjoy it slowly while she perused social media. With her bag of food in her hand, Asha quietly opened the door from the garage into the house. From upstairs, she could hear the sound of Oliver practicing his trombone in his bedroom. The bathroom door off the kitchen was closed, and she could hear some sort of newscast. Phil was in there, scrolling through Twitter, no doubt. She kicked off her shoes and trotted barefoot down the hall. Just as she was about to turn into her office, she stopped. Mia was in there on her phone. Asha was about to go in anyway when Mia's voice stopped her cold. Her daughter was upset. Angry. Scary.
Screw you,
Mia said.
Screw all of you.
Asha took a step back and covered her mouth with her free hand. Mia never spoke like that. Mia never went in her office. In fact, Mia rarely raised her voice or even left her own room for any reason other than to join the family at the dinner table.
No,
Mia said, and Asha heard a drawer slam closed.
No, I said no.
Why not go on in, say hello, and act like everything was normal? It was her office, after all. But that wasn't going to happen. This wasn't a conversation Asha felt comfortable interrupting. In fact, she felt like she needed to hear the whole thing.
I told you, I don't want anything to do with it. Not only do I not want to be a part of it, I don't even want to talk about it. Do what you want to do, but do it without me. I don't care.
There was a long pause, and then Mia screamed like a crazy person.
I don't care, I don't care, I don't care. You know what, Sloan? Tell Reed I said to fuck off and leave me alone.
It sounded like the conversation was over. Asha didn't want Mia to catch her eavesdropping on such a personal exchange. And, she thought, really, what more could a mom want than a daughter who felt comfortable saying no to something she didn't want to do?
This is good,
Asha whispered, trying to comfort herself as she tiptoed back the opposite way down the hall. Phil surprised her just as she was about to turn the corner into the kitchen, and she let out a quick, sharp scream.
Whoa, he said. Sorry. Are you okay?
She was not okay.
She thrust the McDonald's towards him and said, I brought you a snack as a surprise. I've got to go to our room for a second.
Thanks, he called after her, opening the bag.
Upstairs, she ran down the corridor, realizing she was going to be sick. It was no use. She wasn't going to make it to her own. She veered into Mia's room and then her bathroom, and after throwing up several times, she fell back and wiped her mouth with toilet paper. Mia was standing in the doorway.
Hey, honey, she said. I'm sorry. I must have eaten something bad and couldn't make it to...
Mia cut her off.
I'd prefer it if you didn't come in my room anymore without my permission.
What?
You heard me,
Mia said, crossing her arms across her chest.
Am I allowed some privacy in this family, or is it only Dad that gets to do whatever he wants without telling the rest of us where he goes or who he sees?
Mia, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about personal autonomy, okay? Can you please just leave my room so I can have my own space to my own self?
Asha pulled herself up and left, staggering into the hallway, feeling sicker than before. She had followed the rules and tried to be the best she could be for all of them. And yet, what has become of the family that was supposed to love me? 13. Brooke stood on her deck, which was high above the road that ran alongside the river and Main Street. Down below, the cars coming and going looked like toys. The clock tower at the Falcon campus stuck up in the center of it all like the middle finger. Like it was saying, good job, Brooke Elliman, your daughter's a whore. She'd said things she regretted, shouted things, while Sloane sat at the kitchen table, picking at a hangnail until it bled. Brooke had asked her, did you want those boys to think you have no self-respect? That your body is theirs for pleasure without your consent? That you don't love yourself enough to choose who gets to enjoy your beauty? My God! Brooke hadn't been prepared for this, so her words fell out of her mouth like she was quoting some self-help manual from the discount table at the bookstore. It sounded cliche and puritanical, and she doubted she was reaching her daughter. Why? Sloane, answer me. Why?
Those photos were just for Reed. It was bad timing that I sent them to him while he was at Alistair's birthday party, and some guys were looking over his shoulder. I never meant for anyone else to see them, and neither did Reed. It was between me and my boyfriend, and it got out of control. I do have self-respect, and it was a mistake. I made a mistake.
Did he ask you to do it, or did you do it on your own?
He asked me, but I said yes. Please, Mom, drop it. I don't want anyone else to know or anyone to get into any more trouble.
That conversation had taken place 2 days earlier, after the meeting at the school. Brooke had forced herself to take some time to think, process, and cool down before she allowed herself to react. Time was up. She couldn't wait any longer. She wouldn't go to the police, per her daughter's request, but she wasn't going to pretend it hadn't happened. In the distance, there were fields dotted with small objects. Cows, horses, haystacks. Light green grass gave way to red boulders and gray peaks. There was still snow. There would always be snow. Brooke could see, though it was just a speck on the mountain opposite, the apartment building where Gabe no longer lived. There was also a paved road leading away from town, up, up into the adjacent hills, toward the Lelands Ranch, and many of the other high-priced homes where families were raising boys that liked to look at and share photos of her daughter's naked body. Brooke raised her phone and took a deep breath. Hello, Mrs. Solomon. This is Brooke Elliman calling in regard to... Well, I'm sure you know why I'm calling. If you could get back to me at this number, I would very much appreciate it. She returned to her laptop and scrolled through her PTA directory until she came across the number for the Woodsons. Before dialing, she took a swig of her cake bread Cabernet. Yes, hello, Mrs. Woodson. This is Brooke Elliman calling. If you would give me a call back at this number, I would very much appreciate it. She repeated this procedure two more times, leaving the exact same message for the parents of Casper Nowak and Alistair Reynolds. There was just one call left to make. Reed's mother, Linda. Before dialing, Brooke poured another glass of wine and sat there, staring at it for a full minute. Then she upended it into her mouth and drank the entire thing. "Hello, Linda. This is Brooke Elliman calling. If you would give me a call back at this number, I would very much..." She paused, feeling the wine pushing back up her throat. Fat Richard's deep head oral anesthetic spray. The Let's Do It dice game. An awesome fucking game. Mint chocolate chip flavored lube. The future. Sloane's future possibly ruined. The family embarrassed. In the eyes of the world, the Elliman cake billionaire humiliated and humbled. "I would very much like to speak to you about what your son has done to my daughter." "Brooke?" Linda Leland suddenly picked up, and Brooke was absolutely astonished. Yes, it's me." "Hi, I feel so bad about everything. I'm glad you called. It's so important that we talk about this for the sake of the kids." "You're aware of what your son did?" "I'm aware of what our kids did together, yes. Oh my gosh, it's so very upsetting."
"What they did together?"
"Together, yes," Linda said. "I'm extremely disappointed with Reed and his friends, but Sloane can be very convincing. She's remarkably mature, isn't she?"
"She's 15, Linda."
Linda's voice was a little dreamy, like a stoned poet with a guitar on her lap. "Please, Brooke. It just means, you know, that some girls are ready for things before we, as parents, are ready for them to be ready."
"That's bullshit. That makes no sense. Are you high?"
"I'm sure it's very hard for you to hear this, Brooke, but the whole thing was Sloane's idea."
"Linda, come on. We were both teenagers once. I know you don't have a daughter, but you have to understand that these girls, they don't plot their own abuse."
"Well, it's a little more nuanced than that, I think, Brooke," Linda answered in a sing-song way. "Reed was the only recipient of a gift from your daughter. My husband and I believe taking those photos for him was an honest, loving gesture on her part, no matter how poor her judgment may have been. But trust me, Brooke, I do realize my son isn't completely innocent."
Brooke resisted the urge to throw the phone against the wall.
"I want a formal apology, in writing, a confession, if you will." "Reed would be happy to apologize. That's a great idea. They can exchange apologies, and that will really help the healing process."
"No, you don't understand what I'm saying. I want to see real consequences."
Linda was quiet for a second and then said,
"Is that how we're going to talk to each other then?"
"Yes, Reed should be punished. I would like to see your son dressed in a jumpsuit, picking up trash with his bare hands on the side of the highway."
"Fine. How about this? Reed no longer picks up trash. I've told him to stay away from your daughter."
Linda was clearly awake now, and her soothing tone had been replaced by steel.
"You bitch," Brooke said. "How dare you?"
"Mom," Sloane yelled, coming up behind her and grabbing the cell phone out of her hand. "Mom, stop. What are you doing?"
Sloane ended the call. Brooke stood up, found that she was shaking, and all she could think to do was grab her daughter. She pulled Sloane in for a desperate hug.
"What's wrong with you?" Sloane asked.
"I don't know," Brooke whispered. "I don't know. I swear to God, I'm ready to murder someone."
Police video excerpt, Falcon Academy conference room interview, Bellman, Natalie Marie, continued.
"Do you want to tell us any more about this tie?"
Detective Bradley asks.
"I don't have anything more to tell you about the tie other than what I've already told you," Natalie answers.
"Do you want to tell me anything more about anything? This is getting exasperating. If you're innocent, you should be talking more."
"I'm just tired."
"Well, guess what, young lady? We're tired too. We're all tired. Work is tiring. Investigations are tiring."
Natalie nodded in agreement.
"You know I'm gonna keep doubling back on you."
Natalie spoke so softly that it was almost not an answer. "Okay, whatever that means."
We went over this. The people from the surveillance video that were in the gym yesterday are, in the following order, Assistant Athletic Director Nicholas McGuire, Linda Leland and her 17-year-old son Reed, Reed's 15-year-old girlfriend Sloan Elliman Holt, and Sloan's mother, Brooke Elliman, and a woman by the name of Asha Wilson. And then there was you, in and out twice.
And I said, fine, I don't know, but if that's what you say, I believe you.
Out of those people, who had problems with who?
Who had problems with who? Natalie laughed. Everyone had problems with everyone. The whole bunch. Every single last one of them had a reason to hate the other. Sometimes it felt like I was trying to do my job in a shark tank. 14. On the last day of school, it was all Natalie could do to stop herself from joining the students as they ran and wrestled in the halls, honked their horns, and blared music in the parking lot. It was summer vacation, and she would have Nick all to herself without the frustration of the Falcon moms flirting with him at every opportunity. She and Nick both had summer work responsibilities at the school, though far less than during the academic year. Her plan was to spend as much time as possible with Nick and to move the evolving relationship forward from where it seemed stuck in the casual fun zone. 2 weeks, 2 wonderful weeks of summer vacation passed by in a heartbeat. During that time, when they saw each other at school, Natalie's eyes would meet Nick's, and all it took was a small conspiratorial smile to make them sneak off to a storage closet or an empty classroom. They had been on several walks in the woods, a couple of visits to Sonic to get Jackson his popcorn chicken, and an evening drive in Nick's truck up to a scenic overlook, where they'd held hands and watched the sunset. They'd never been out for a real date. Jay had pointed out that this was strange, but Natalie was willing to wait. It seemed like perhaps her patience was about to be rewarded. Nick had asked her to meet him in the athletic office that afternoon, and she'd had a nervous but hopeful feeling that they were about to take some sort of meaningful next step. The school was mostly silent, and the halls without windows were gloomy. In the courtyard, the fountain continued to recycle its water and spit it into arcs over a beady-eyed, predatory falcon, but there was no one around throwing coins. When Natalie arrived at the office to meet Nick, it was empty. Planning to look for him up on the mezzanine, she returned down the hall, which was lined with photo after photo of Falcon teams dating back decades. A picture hanging opposite the doors to the basketball courts caught her eye. She'd never taken much interest in the endless row of photos, but today the corridor was quiet and eerie, and something about this one had captured her attention for the first time. It was a portrait, just one girl kneeling with a soccer ball. All the team photos had the same plain wooden frame, but this one was special. It was shiny and silver. Natalie leaned in to read the small print and realized the photo was of Jill Ruiz, the daughter, she assumed, of the woman Natalie had seen kneeling by the memorial stone bench on the ridge overlooking the valley and the school.
Natalie!
She spun around. There was Nick, silhouetted in the sunlight streaming in through the window behind him. She ran, and when she reached him, threw her arms around his neck. Hey, she said, burying her nose in his chest. Are you all done with work?
I am, he said. Listen, I kind of went out on a limb and bought some stuff to make you dinner. Would that be fun? Are you hungry?
He seemed nervous, and she found it incredibly cute and sexy.
I mean, I don't know. Do you want to have dinner and hang out after? We could maybe get in the hot tub later.
Yes, Natalie said. Yes to it all. It wasn't just a hookup. It was a real date. An hour later, Nick was cooking in loose athletic shorts and a t-shirt. The sliding doors leading off the kitchen were open. Jackson was happily gnawing on a dried pig ear while sunning himself on the balcony. Natalie was barefoot, and Nick was in a talkative mood. He opened a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc and poured himself a glass.
I know you don't drink, he said, but it goes against my upbringing to not at least offer. Is that wrong?
Am I being bad?
Not at all, Natalie said. I'll have a little bit. It felt nice, after several years, to have a small amount of quality wine in a long-stemmed glass. She swirled it around, smelled it, and tasted it.
You look like a wine snob, he said, laughing.
Oh, you know it, she answered. Only the best. This barely meets my minimum criteria. The bouquet is off.
You're kidding, right?
Of course I am. I don't know much about wine. My brother and I used to sometimes drink Gallo. I think it was like $4 for a jug that was bigger than my head.
Nick ripped open the bag of penne and dumped it into the boiling water. While stirring it with a wooden spoon, he said,
You're very easy to be with.
Thank you, she said, raising her glass. So are you.
Makes me wish I had never...
He stopped stirring, looked back at her, and said,
Never mind.
Never what? She asked, taking a sip of her wine.
It's complicated.
Come on, Nick, he said. It's okay. What?
Never wasted so much of my life on a certain type of person. You know about Millie, right? It seems like everyone does.
Millie is Amélie Bernard, the actress?
Yes.
I only know what I've heard around the school. This was a lie. Are you still... Natalie hesitated. Involved with her?
Nick peered down into the pasta water, and it was clear that he was buying time.
It's been a difficult relationship. She and I have broken up and gotten back together many times. At this point, we haven't seen one another in 4 months.
That's not exactly an answer to my question.
Nick nodded.
I know. I'm sorry. I don't want to lie to you.
Natalie tried not to let the devastation show.
I see. I feel like maybe that's my cue to go.
No, please don't go. I'm going to tell you the truth.
Her stomach was in knots as she waited.
I can handle it.
She wasn't sure if she could or not.
Millie and I have an agreement. We called it the Dignity Pact. The idea was that if we fooled around with someone, it was best to spare one another the pain of going over the details. But if we moved on into a real relationship, we promised we would tell each other so that no one was humiliated or, you know, had the rug pulled out from under them.
And
I've been waiting to see where this thing between us is going. I haven't told her about you yet. Maybe I should have. I was being cautious. I don't even know if you would take this seriously, given that you're so young compared to me. It's a scary feeling. That's the truth.
Natalie took another sip of her wine.
You're not going to leave?
He asked. No, I'm not going to leave.
He pulled over one of the kitchen chairs so that he was sitting and facing her. He took her hand in his.
So?
So?
She repeated.
So... I think I just kind of asked you if you're serious about me.
Natalie leaned forward and kissed him gently.
I am.
The penne was overcooked into a rubbery mess when they came back from the bedroom a half hour later, so Nick had to throw it out and start over. They drank more wine. It was delicious and made Natalie feel warm, fuzzy, and funny, and she wanted more, more, more. That was the problem. And why she'd stopped drinking in the first place. After they ate and Jackson had his dinner, they all three went into the living room. The big dog required half the couch, so Nick and Natalie sat practically on top of one another on the other side.
Do you want to watch something?
Nick asked.
Maybe listen to some music?
Sure, she said, a glimmer of mean tease in her eye. I'm okay with, like, Frank Sinatra or whatever old vinyl records you have around.
Oh,
he said, pretending to be offended.
I see how it is. Very funny. I think you might have me confused with my dad. I'm 48, not 78.
She held the couch pillow up against her face to stifle her laughter.
And guess what? I do have some Frank Sinatra. So now you're going to pay for age-shaming me because we're going to listen to Frank. All night long, on repeat, while you try to sleep, like you're a prisoner of war.
You know what we should do?
Not listen to Frank Sinatra?
We should go outside and sit on the patio. It's such a pretty night. I've got something nice from my brother we could smoke.
I don't smoke,
Nick answered quickly. Oh, that's okay, Natalie said, faking a contrite look. I don't very often.
I don't like to do too much of anything that messes with the temple, if you know what I mean.
I can see that, she said, reaching out to put her hand on his six-pack stomach. And a very nice temple it is.
Thank you. But just because I don't want to smoke in my lungs, well, with all the training I do, doesn't mean I don't like to relax, he said. I think I might still have a couple of pot brownies from the dispensary in the pantry, but I definitely know I have a bag of gummies.
That's even better. You scared me there for a second. I was afraid you thought I was some sort of drug addict.
Nah, he said. I'm one of the cool kids. Which would you prefer, if it turns out I do have them both?
Gummy, I think.
I'll be right back.
The wine and the sex and the delicious dinner and the fluffy dog, Natalie had not been so relaxed and carefree in a long time. He came back into the room a minute later with two candies on a napkin. She plucked one up and looked at it. How potent are they? Do you know?
They're 10 milligrams.
Oh, perfect. I haven't had one of these in a long time, but I'm pretty sure the last time I did, it was shaped like an actual Haribo gummy bear.
Not anymore, he said. They changed it so kids don't accidentally eat them, even though some kids these days do stuff that's way crazier than edibles.
I'm sure, she said, putting the candy in her mouth. I've heard about our students and all the trouble they get into at their parties.
It's probably worse than you think. Honestly, I've seen some pretty shocking stuff.
Natalie resituated herself so that she could look straight at him. Now I'm intrigued.
Can you keep a secret? Seriously, if this were to get out, I would probably lose my job.
I won't say a word.
Well, he said. Okay, I've been dying to tell someone. It has to do with all that hullabaloo in the office a few weeks back. You must have been wondering what was going on.
Of course, the dingoes and their parents. Sudden mysterious suspensions.
Yes, so you know Alistair Reynolds, right? His mom asked me and a couple of others from the sports office, Coach Carmen and Coach Andy, to chaperone an overnight birthday party for him on their ranch in Basalt.
The mom wanted a woman to help chaperone a boy's sleepover birthday party? Nick laughed.
Yes, I think a lot of the moms like it when Coach Carmen is there too. Kind of like the woman is the chaperone for the chaperones.
Really? Okay.
Anyway, the Reynolds barn has bunk beds and can comfortably sleep 24.
Just a nice little guest house for their second home.
Exactly. Carmen and Andy were going to ride out with me in the van with the boys, 10 of them, leaving on a Friday after school. And Alistair's little brother, Edmund, was there with two friends. And it wasn't a van that showed up. It was a Hummer limo for 20 stocked with snacks. They weren't drinking outright in front of us, but it was clear a few of them had brought some little bottles and were sneaking it into their cokes.
You're kidding. What did you do?
I kept an eye on the situation, but in a way, my hands were tied. When the parents are paying you gazillions of dollars an hour to do these events, it's kind of agreed that you're going to look the other way when it comes to a little bit of boys being boys. But then it got worse. There was a feast when we arrived. Two caterers serving bison fillet, wild duck, local salmon. But no one was eating because they were all in the bathrooms. I decided I was going to go bust them for whatever they were snorting, but when I went in, I found a group of 10 boys looking at some images on a phone that they obviously found very shocking and funny. They didn't even know I was there. They were so glued to the screen. I leaned over and had a look. It was upsetting.
What was it?
Photos of a falcon girl. Inappropriate photos.
He didn't say the girl's name, but Natalie knew. She'd been there when Mrs. Elliman had showed up at the school looking like the world had ended.
I confiscated the phone with the images, but they'd already been shared. I called Alistair's mom, who was up at the main house, and told her the party was over and why. She was furious with me. The shit hit the fan. I literally considered going to the police. I had a very serious disagreement about how to handle it with another one of the coaches, of which you're aware.
I am? Natalie asked, and then remembered the afternoon when Coach Carmen had nearly knocked her over in the stairwell. She was so angry and out of control, running away from a conversation with Nick.
Oh, right, she said. I know what you're talking about.
In the end, I took the matter to the headmaster. Bringing that to the attention of Mr. Dilly and having to deal with the parents' reactions was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. And the poor girl, she's definitely been damaged by the experience.
What a nightmare.
It's infuriating,
Nick said, closing his eyes and shaking his head.
Right before I stopped the party, Carmen said to me, Are you sure you want to do this? Look around. I bet you we're looking at the sons of the wealthiest, most powerful families in the whole damn state. Maybe the country. And I thought to myself, I know stuff about these kids that could ruin their lives. I mean, literally ruin their lives. I know the crimes. I know the drugs. I know the lies and the cover-ups. I was just sick of it. I didn't want to look the other way this time. Even now, I feel like I should have done more. But would I have lost my job? I don't know. They were punished, yes, but to the extent that they should have been, they missed some school, got slapped on the wrist. I'm so angry. Do you know what I mean?
I do, Nick, she said. I understand exactly how you feel.
It's nice,
he said, putting his arm around her and pulling her in close.
To be with someone who not only understands, but is the complete opposite of all of that.
He kissed Natalie's jaw, and she felt the urge to pull him down on top of her again.
Anyway, there was a lot of resentment against me for reporting it, among the boys' parents blaming one another, and even against the girl who was the victim. I've never seen civilized people acting so crazy. I honestly thought they were going to kill each other.
15. With Phil out of town again, negotiating a big deal, Asha was on her own to accompany Mia to the meeting with Mr. McGuire to get her signed up for summer private training. A gray rubber wedge held open the front door of the sports pavilion. Asha and Mia went inside. There was a small lobby, a short flight of stairs that went up to the gym, and a long hall that led back to the locker rooms, the pool, and the stairs to the mezzanine. In front of them was a brick wall with a window. On the other side of the glass, Coach Carmen stood up and waved them around to the door. The sports office was a large room lined with desks and computers. Coach Carmen gestured towards two chairs. Welcome to my cubicle, she said. Please have a seat. I was under the impression we were meeting with Mr. McGuire this evening, Asha responded, sitting. Yes, that's right, and I'm Carmen Sorella. The kids know me as Coach Carmen. Coach Nick got stuck in some traffic, and he'll be about 15 minutes late. We can get started without him. I'm the licensed physical therapist, so I would be the one helping Mia deal with the issue of her shin splints. A great deal of her therapy would be under my supervision. Carmen began to detail at length the different ways she planned to help Mia with her injury. Pain reduction, gait analysis, muscle stretches and strengthening, range of motion work, custom orthotics for arch support, and on. Asha tried to focus. Carmen was saying, With an emphasis on activity modification over the summer, we can really reduce- I'm sorry, Asha interrupted. What activity modification are we talking about? Replacing high impact with swimming and cycling primarily, keeping the pressure off the shins. So far, the meeting was not going the way Asha wanted. She was there to get extra special help and attention from Mr. McGuire, not activity modification from Coach Carmen. You know, Asha said, we're not really here for this small problem with Mia's shin splints. It's not too big of a concern, really. Oh, I'm afraid I would have to disagree, Carmen said. Are you in pain when you're playing, Mia? A little, she answered. After glancing at her mom, she said, Like, sometimes, not all the time. Asha was not interested in paying $120 an hour to Coach Carmen for instructing Mia on the proper way to do toe raises for calf strengthening. This was about Mia being recruited for a Division I college team of her liking. Mia has played soccer since she was 5, and her shin splints have only been a nuisance, which we've treated with ibuprofen. They haven't stopped her from being one of the most promising players that Falcon has seen in many years. I was given the impression that these private training sessions were designed to advance-
Mrs. Wilson, Mia,
Nick said, rushing through the door of the sports office like he'd just sprinted across town.
So sorry I'm a few minutes late,
Mia mumbled. Thank God, at the same time that her mom stood up to reach for his hand. I'm so glad you're here,
Asha said. It seems like maybe there was some confusion about the reason we set up this meeting.
Really? Nick asked. What's the problem?
We're more interested in a proactive approach to preparing Mia for the recruitment process than we are in her undergoing lengthy physical therapy for a minor injury. Coach Carmen didn't say anything, but she was obviously annoyed.
Okay, I see,
Nick said, grabbing a chair and rolling it over.
Don't worry. I'll be working closely with Mia on all aspects of her preparation for college sports. She's going to get a lot of individual attention from me and Coach Carmen. That's the way we run the program. We share all the hats. Coach Carmen was probably discussing her plan of action to address Mia's injury, which is crucial if you want to have Mia playing at her optimal level next fall. I'll be stepping in on a regular basis to work with Mia on strategies for achieving her highest level of fitness and nutrition, as well as balancing the stress of homework and academic performance with the pressure that comes along with her unusual athletic talent.
Asha was finally pleased. And what about preparing the package? I heard from Brooke Elliman that there are a number of things we can do to promote Mia in the eyes of the top schools, that there is something like a package with videos, letters, essays, etc.
Yes, Nick said. I'll spearhead that for Mia, everything you mentioned and then some, and I will be personally reaching out to my own network on Mia's behalf. My goal is to get Mia at some tournaments and camps next fall, where she can be noticed by the scouts representing her favorite schools.
That sounds amazing, Asha responded. Mia, doesn't that sound amazing? Totally amazing, Mia said. Asha darted a look to see if that was sarcasm and embarrassment in her daughter's voice. It was. Asha wondered if Mia would prefer if she never spoke at all. Nick pulled a piece of paper from a folder on the desk and looked it over briefly. Then he turned to Mia and said,
I made these notes the last time you and I sat down to do an evaluation of your experience here at Falcon. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but this is what I came away with from our discussion. Mia's dream college would be strong in liberal arts, ideally offering a film undergraduate degree.
Asha was nodding along as he talked up to this point, but then, little by little, she began to feel uncomfortable.
Mia is looking for a change, an environment that is inclusive as well as diverse. She sometimes feels lonely in Falcon Valley, lacking in positive interactions with others of her ethnicity, and without positive role models who...
Asha's eyes slid to the side to see how Mia was reacting to this bullshit. No positive role models? What? I'm sitting right here. But Mia wasn't rolling her eyes. She was watching him intently, and he kept glancing up at her as he talked.
One thing Mia knows for sure is that she wants to be able to travel, both domestically and internationally, with a view to one day living and working overseas, possibly in Southeast Asia with a particular interest in Thailand. So, a school with a variety of foreign study opportunities abroad would be ideal.
Asha coughed and tried to smile, but she was absolutely sick. A semester overseas was one thing, but moving abroad? Did Mia want to get as far away from her as possible?
I think a UC school rather than a private institution. No fake utopias. Real people, multicultural, progressive values, more adventure. A place where she can reinvent herself a little bit.
Reinvent as who? Asha thought angrily.
Did I get that right, Mia?
He asked. You did, Mia said. Just right.
In the meantime, he said, turning to address Asha, the best thing we can do is to make sure the university Mia wants will want her in return. Coach Carmen and I are pretty sure we can make that happen.
Coach Carmen, who'd been silent all this time, gave everyone a thin smile and a somewhat insincere nod of agreement. Asha turned again to look at Mia, who was glowing, pleased, validated, enjoying the spectacle of her mother realizing how little she understood about her plans to be reborn as someone totally different and then escape from her tedious family.
Of course, he went on, we need to be realistic. There's a lot of competition for those coveted spots. Even right here at our rather small school, there are contenders. It's going to be fierce.
Asha took a deep breath, choked down her ire, and said, Whatever you think is best, I'll defer to your judgment. She reached into her bag and produced her checkbook. Mia, you know I support your choices. What do you want to do? Start the privates next week? At home, an hour later,
Asha said to the black cylinder sitting on the counter next to the 60-jar wooden rotating spice rack. Alexa, set timer for 5 minutes. The sleek electronic device lit up briefly with a blue glow and responded in a polished feminine voice. 5 minutes, starting now. Asha flipped each of the 4 chicken breasts sizzling in the pan and went back to her kitchen laptop. The page she had open said, "Your due date is," she typed in, "December 16th. Congratulations, you are 11 weeks and 1 day pregnant. Your baby is the size of a fig. Your baby will be a Sagittarius whose birthstone will be turquoise." Following the initial rush of euphoria was a sour surge of anxiety. Asha had waited far too long to tell Phil. It had to be tonight. She couldn't keep it to herself any longer, and if he was unhappy about it, that was just tough. The Alexa alarm went off, and Asha was, for one unsettling second, reminded of the oven timer beeping in the Leopold house a few weeks earlier, just before she'd found the pillow that stank of marijuana. Asha turned off the heat underneath the chicken, covered the pan, and walked up the stairs and down the hall to give Oliver a dinner warning. He got upset if he was in the middle of a game and was forced to leave without plenty of advanced notice. She paused outside his room. Oliver was seated at his desk in front of his computer, wearing the headset that Phil had gotten him for his birthday, playing Fortnite. When she knocked, he gave her a quick wave that was not a greeting, but rather a dismissal. "Go away." Asha poked her nose in. "Hi, Oliver," she said, glancing around. It smelled like rotten fruit. "Dinner in 30. Oliver cast a confused look in her direction, then back at the screen. He yanked his headset off. "What? I was in the middle of a round and now I'm dead." "I'm sorry. Dinner in 30, Asha said, retreating. "That's all." Oliver put his headphones back on and went back to pounding the keys. Phil was still not home. Mia was in her room studying. The burner underneath the chicken was off and the rice was on simmer. There was no reason she couldn't lie down for 10 minutes. The idea of closing her eyes, even for a brief amount of time, was intoxicating. She went into her room, closed the blinds, and stretched out on the bed. From down the hall, she could hear Oliver shouting at the top of his lungs. "Over there! He's over there! Hit one! Hit one! One down! One down!" Asha pulled a blanket over her face. It didn't help. She said to her bedroom Alexa, "Alexa, play Babbling Brook." The sound of water rushing over stones in the wilderness filled the room and drowned out Oliver's voice. Asha closed her eyes. That's how Phil found her 45 minutes later.
"There you are," he said, standing in the double doorway. "I didn't even know you were in the house."
Asha tried to sit up. "I fell asleep."
"I can see that. You left the stove on and came up to take a nap?"
Asha was suddenly very awake. "Why are you talking to me like that?"
"What, in an irritated tone? Maybe because I'm irritated with you."
"Why?"
"Because irresponsible behavior irritates me, and you've been acting irresponsibly lately."
"Jesus," Asha said, rolling off the bed. "What have I done?"
"You don't know where your keys are. Have you seen my phone? What day is it again? Napping, leaving the stove on, and—"
He paused dramatically.
"Mia says you signed a form for her, saying she's allowed to get medical injections from the trainer. No one said anything to me. Did you do that?"
"The medicine for Mia is just an anti-inflammatory shot every once in a while when she needs it. It's no stronger than Advil."
"Then why not just give her Advil?"
"I don't know. I'm not the trainer, am I? This is what college athletes do, okay? It's supposed to cure her shin splints so that she'll be competitive next fall when the recruiters are all scouting her. It's very common, just a little prick." This made her laugh. "Little prick, kind of like the way you're acting right now."
"Oh, so this is funny to you?"
"Kind of, yeah, it is. Two can play this stupid game, you know. I can ask you what the hell is wrong with you lately."
"I'm trying to close a big deal, and on top of that, I'm worried. I'm worried about work, I'm worried about the kids, and I'm worried about you."
Asha thought of what Brooke had said to her at the school movie night weeks earlier. "Phil has a lot going on. Give him some time, you know, to sort things out." So, Brooke had been right. Phil did have worries,
lots of worries. When had he confided in Brooke about these concerns? What the hell was going on? A high school soccer coach knew her own daughter better than she did, and now Brooke had the inside scoop on her husband's mental fitness to deal with family matters, even though they hadn't seen each other in ages? Asha was livid. Oh my God, she said, straightening her clothes. Cut me some slack. So I took a nap. You're overreacting.
If I have to go out of town on business, I need to know that you're manning the ship.
He filled the doorway, stopping her from going past. I'm manning the ship, Philip. Get out of my way. You're being a ridiculous asshole. He stepped aside and said,
Am I?
Yes, you are, she said, heading down the hallway to the top of the stairs.
I'm not the ridiculous asshole who signed my teenage daughter up for private training sessions with David Beckham. I believe the ridiculous asshole who did that without talking to me first was you, Asha.
We did talk about it.
I never said yes. I would not have said yes. Have you seen the handout the trainer sent home with her? Pills containing eggshell membranes, hot stone therapy and foot arch massages, training logs and a special diet?
She wanted to.
Mia wants to swim with sea turtles in Micronesia and dig latrines for orphans in Guatemala, but we're not signing her up for that tomorrow.
I think it will be good for her.
You think it's going to be good for her to do these shady-ass private sessions with Rob fucking Lowe?
Do you have any other reason for not liking Mr. McGuire, aside from the fact that he's an attractive man?
Phil ran a hand through his hair. He was sweating.
What if she decides she, you know, likes him?
Asha laughed out loud. That is crazy, Phil. That is the craziest thing I've ever heard. He's got to be, what, 45?
I've seen how women around here act when he walks up. Every single one of you reaches for your lipstick at the exact same second.
Not me. Don't lump me in with them.
I'm right, though, aren't I?
Mia's not going to develop a crush on Mr. McGuire, Phil.
How can you be so sure?
What was the name of her last boyfriend? Asha demanded. No, better yet, name one boy she's ever been interested in. Phil frowned. You can't, because it hasn't happened, even though she's 15 and drop-dead stunning and her best friend has a boyfriend.
What are you implying?
Phil asked, following Asha.
You can't just walk away after making a claim like that. Do you know something I don't know?
Shh, she'll hear you, Asha said, navigating the stairs with one hand on the banister.
Does that mean what I think it means?
I don't know what it means. It could mean anything, but what if it does? Asha asked. Are you going to call up my uncles in Mumbai and get the wheels turning on an arranged marriage? You're acting like a Neanderthal. Leave her alone. And you know what? Leave me alone, too. Phil followed her down the stairs and grabbed her arm.
This is serious. Don't play with me.
No, Phil, don't play with me. I'm 11 weeks pregnant, and our baby is the size of a fig, and I am tired and forgetful and also extremely hormonal. I'm not having this conversation with you right now.
You're pregnant?
He asked, his face turning quickly from flushed to a milky white. Yes, I am. Now take your hand off my arm and walk away right now before I yell for the kids and tell them Daddy is hurting me and I need help. Do you understand? Apparently, he did.